You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko Caden toku ingoa, nō mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rāpare Thursday. My name is Caden and I'm your host for today. I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in the studio by producer Panuja. Ewha akene coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to MP Shannon Halbert on whether New Zealand should be involved in the United States-Israel-Iran conflict and the results of the recent Crimes and Victims Survey. I also spoke to Thomas Beagle from the New Zealand Council for Civil Liberties about the United States government getting automated access to New Zealanders' biometric data. Producer Theo spoke to Yua Wei, University of Auckland's Honorary Associate Professor Susan St. John, on the Social Security Amendment Bill currently being rushed through Parliament. For City Councilling this week, News Director Castor spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about the Council's annual plan for 2026-27 and the move-on orders for rough sleepers. He aha o whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai. Text in on 5395 or Wire Mai Rane, give us a call in studio on 309 3879. Ka e wariwari I ahiana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero anō, he pakehere rokiroki maronga I te pai, tukutuku o Irirangi Pōho, mi haere ki 95BFM, irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Text in your thoughts on Rima Toru Iwa Rima 5395 or give us a call in studio on Toru Kore Iwa Toru Waru Fitu Iwa 309 3879. Now let's get into the show.
It's time for our weekly catch up with Labour MP Shannon Halbert.
Labour leader Chris Hipkins has stated that the United States and Israel breached international law with their bombing of Iran, especially with the strike that killed 150 people at a primary girls' school. While former Labour Prime Minister Helen Clark says New Zealand should not provide military support for an illegal invasion of Iran. And the New Zealand Crimes and Victims Survey has published its latest results for the year leading up to October 2025. The results showed 49,000 fewer victims of violent crime, with the government saying this is because of their tough-on-crime approach and a near doubling of police foot patrols. For our weekly catch-up with the Labour Party, I spoke to MP Shannon Halbert about both of these topics. I started by asking if New Zealand should support the United States military campaign in Iran.
Absolutely not. We don't support the attack on Iran. And can I just acknowledge for a moment those that have been affected by the thousands of deaths that we've experienced as a result of these actions.
Are you concerned that New Zealand is in a position where we've increasingly aligned ourselves with the United States on foreign policy and now might be liable for this?
Not at this stage. I think it's important to acknowledge that New Zealand must always use its voice on the world stage. In this instance, calling for de-escalation, for a return to negotiations and for the right for Iranian people to be able to determine their own future. A number of New Zealanders, Aucklanders, have been in touch with me because they are just gobsmacked by the actions in this instance, the impact of war and the concerns globally of how that will come filter back to New Zealand and impact us all.
The Greens asked the government to commit to automatically extending visas for people in New Zealand whose home countries have been affected by the war. Is this something Labour supports?
So that's yet to be discussed, but I was a part of the Select Committee yesterday that raised such an issue with Minister Erica Stanford. I think it's important at the moment that we call for restraint, that diplomacy is in place, and that we continue to support the Iranian people to define their own future. But we do play a role as New Zealand to enable them to come to a safe place, and no doubt those decisions will be made in due course.
How else should the government help New Zealanders and others who are affected by this war?
I think it's important that we continue to use our voice on the world stage, as we have for decades. I remember growing up, and I go back to the attack on Iraq as an example. And New Zealanders at that time, and I believe now, you know, want restraint. They want peace. They do not want war. And so that's the role of New Zealand, to stand up for that. And we urge the government to do so as well.
And I want to ask now about the recent crime and victim survey. What is your response to the fact that 49,000 fewer people are victims of violent crime in last year compared to 2 years ago?
I'm not convinced by that personally. I think we have to ask whether violent crime is really actually coming down, especially now that the number of gang members has actually surpassed the number of police out on the beat. This government under Christopher Luxon promised that they would have more police out on the beat, but what we are seeing, in fact, is that we have more gang members registered than police, and that's a broken promise on their behalf.
Do you agree with the government that it's their tough-on-crime policies in action that are working?
I don't agree with the government's actions. I think that they have focused on punitive actions that don't actually resolve the real issue at heart. We can use slogans that we're tough on crime, but actually the results do speak for themselves. We have an incredible problem with meth in New Zealand, as an example, that has been growing. Gang numbers have been growing. So typical of this government and Christopher Luxon that they actually don't address the real issues. And I think move-on orders is just another example. You're not addressing homelessness. You're taking punitive approaches to manage a situation that you don't want to see.
And the results weren't spread evenly across demographics. Are you concerned that 5,000 more Pacific peoples have been victims of violent crime in the same period?
Absolutely, Māori and Pacific. Women continue to be overrepresented in this area. And yes, we do need to be concerned absolutely about victims and prevention, and at the same time ensure that rehabilitation is in place. We have to be clear that family violence is up. Those statistics have gone through the roof. And we heard that only a few weeks ago through Salvation Army reports.
Can you outline what Labor will do to support victims of violent crime?
Labor's got a track record of supporting victims of violent crime. We will take an empathetic approach. As we move through the year, we'll make announcements on our manifesto and policies that will create change in the space.
That was Labor's Shannon Halbert on whether New Zealand should be involved in the United States-Israel-Iran conflict and the results of the recent crime and victim survey.
That was our weekly chat with Labor MP Shannon Halbert.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Auckland Council's annual plan is currently in consultation, open until Sunday, 29th of March. The plan focuses on two key areas for Auckland Council: public transport and water infrastructure. The public transport element is particularly focused on the opening of the City Rail Link, which Council says will massively boost public transport capacity and connectivity across Auckland. The operational costs of the CRL, among other reasons, will contribute to an 8% rates increase for the average value residential property in 2026-27. The water infrastructure updates are also significant, as they follow years of countrywide water infrastructure neglect. As wastewater issues are seen across the country in recent weeks and months, Auckland Transport is looking to make infrastructure upgrades to avoid similar scenarios. This past week has also seen the government propose move-on orders for rough sleepers in cities across the country. The move-on orders have been criticised by some, who say they unnecessarily punish our most vulnerable populations. For City Counselling this week, News Director Castor spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about each of these issues beginning with the annual plan.
What are the Council's key goals with this annual plan for 2026 and 2027?
So the main thing with this annual plan is it's kind of the boring annual plan. This happens every 3 years. We have an annual plan that basically has happened just after the election. And if there hasn't been a lot of change at the election, it's basically a continuation of what was happening. There aren't a lot of big changes proposed, because every next year we do a big plan that's for 10 years. And so this is kind of the last year of that. It's sort of hard to explain, but it's kind of the last year of the first 3 years of the 10 years. That doesn't make sense. Anyway, it's a bit of more of the same, basically, this year. It's a continuation of what Council had committed to last term. We haven't had big political change at the election amongst the councillors or the mayor, and so it's a continuation. The big headline that will jump out at people, though, is the size of the rates increase, which is larger than I think we've had even during emergency budgets during COVID and the storms and all of that stuff. It's 7.9% proposed, which is large, and it's basically because the City Rail Link comes online in the next financial year. Later this year it will be operational, and so a whole lot of costs associated with owning and operating the City Rail Link start to need to be reflected in the rates. And it's not just the actual, that whole increase is not the cost of literally running the trains through the tunnels. Actually, most of it is actually the interest on the debt we are paying to build it in the first place. And we use debt for that stuff so as to spread the burden of paying for it across the generations who will benefit from it. And then another large chunk of it is what's called depreciation, which again is a cost of owning. So it's about putting money aside to pay for the renewal of the asset when it comes due. So only a small portion of that 7.9% is actually running the trains. But the whole of it is about, okay, now we need to, with this amazing transformation, actually put it into the budget, into our operational budget, not just our capital budget. Hopefully that makes sense.
And I wanted to talk about the cause of the rates increase, right, the CRL. What does the opening of the CRL later this year signal for Auckland Transport moving forward?
So I think people are not necessarily understanding yet the transformational aspect of the City Rail Link. It's not just about having a couple more train stations in the city centre. It actually increases capacity right across the train system, even if you're in Pukekohe or Ranui. It also increases capacity for our buses, because people will take buses and then access the train lines. So for people, for example, on the North Shore using the Northern Busway, they will get off in downtown and get into that train system to access the rest of the region as well. So it's actually a big transformational shift for our public transport system. It's kind of like we're a grown-up city once this opens, for those who've travelled overseas. But also what it means for the places that are getting the new stations is major urban renewal. So we're already seeing that around the Karanga Ahape station. I'm in the council building, which is just a diagonal across the road from Te Waihoros 2 station, which will regenerate Midtown. And of course the Mangawhai Mount Eden station, which is in my ward, has all these amazing development sites around it that will spring up with new buildings and open space and retail and residential, all sorts, over the next 10, 15 years. So there's, you know, two really big things for it. There's the urban renewal happening around the station, and then there's the massive increase in capacity that it provides for our whole public transport system. My advice to people is take a train now before the new system is in, and then take a train a year from now and you will see the difference. And it's going to be great.
And while the CRL opening is a big deal, you mentioned all of those benefits that we're going to see around the CBD and around outer suburbs as well. The plan was put forward, you know, in the 2010s, and
Auckland has changed a lot since the plan has come in, and while the plan has evolved, we also see new transport needs popping up all the time. What are the plans after the CRL finishes, after the CRL development finishes, to develop our transport networks further?
So a lot of the next steps are actually around buses, but let's not forget that there's actually several new train stations coming to the Southern Line down in Drury. So if you catch a train now, you'll see there's a map of the train system, and it includes the Northern Busway as well. And you'll see that on the Southern Line schematic, there's a couple of new stations coming there. So that's coming later this year and next year as well. So we are adding to the train system. But the big new, Northwestern Busway is going to be, I mean, they're already building some of that. We had some briefing on that just last week. And in time, that will connect up and come all the way into the city from, you know, out sort of past Westgate, which is amazing. The Eastern Busway is getting closer to completion as well, which is sort of that Pakuranga through to Botany stretch. And also the Avondale Southdown rail line, which would follow the motorway from just by the Packenslave in Mount Albert, if people know where that is, through Onehunga down to the Southern Line and connect the Western and the Southern Lines for the trains. Kiwi Rail is coming out mid-year with some of their plans for where stations might be, what that line might look like. So it's actually, there's a lot of those big projects coming, but also we've been chipping away at increasing the frequency of existing bus services, increasing the capacity of the ones we're already running by shifting to double deckers, moving to electric. There's work happening with the ferries. There's work happening on active transport modes, particularly cycling, although not enough. So it's actually, you know, the city is really making a big transformation in the transport space. To, you know, when I was at uni, I had to catch a bus that was a 15-minute walk from my house that went once an hour, and it didn't run after about 10 o'clock at night. And it took me an hour to get to the city from Glenfield. And so when I reflect on that change in my lifetime, it's huge. But we're going to see even more change over the next 10 years, which is fantastic. As you can tell, I'm really excited.
The plan also has a lot of focus on our water infrastructure in Auckland. What do these upgrades to our water infrastructure look like, and why are they coming about now?
So the main reason they're coming about now is because of decades of neglect. And so water infrastructure, so you've got three types of water. You've got the water that falls from the sky, that's your stormwater, and when we don't do the infrastructure for stormwater right, that's when you get flooding. And obviously a lot of investment coming in that. But I think probably the ones you're more thinking about is the other two waters, which is your tap water, so you know when you turn the tap, you're drinking water, and also the wastewater, and so that's, you know, when you flush the toilet or the water that goes down the sink, whatever. So the wastewater, the central interceptor, which is a massive billion-dollar project that's been slowly building some massive tunnels underground through the western part of the isthmus, that completes later this year as well. And that will basically, what that will look like for people is not much at all, because it's all under the ground, and it's just been slowly working its way through basalt and all of this stuff. But what it will mean is that we can connect up more housing in that area, because we'll have more capacity to take that wastewater through to the treatment plant at Mangere. And also it will mean fewer sewage overflows, and that ultimately end up in our beaches. So it will improve the water quality at our beaches, which will mean that you'll be able to swim there more. It's better for the streams that feed the beaches in terms of the aquatic life and you know, the health of our streams and stuff like that. So it's part of the reason it's been underinvested in is because it's under the ground and people don't see it, and you can't really cut a ribbon on a tunnel that's full of poo, you know. So it's great to see that change in attitude. And the central interceptor, is sort of, that's one that's been talked about for 40 years. And it's really in the last 10 years that it's been able to get off the ground or under the ground and happening. And there's more of those that need to be built as well. I think it's the Northern Interceptor that would be next.
I want to talk about the move-on orders we've seen proposed for rough sleepers around the country. There's this narrative being pushed about rough sleepers disrupting customers and businesses in our CBDs. Is that consistent with what the council is hearing?
No. And I want to be really clear about this. I've been in some of the ministerial safety group meetings around this. The committee I chair has responsibility for homelessness. It's been very clear for some time now that we are talking about two different groups of people. And while I'm excited about transport, I'm really angry about the move-on orders. It's a real contrast. So we know that there are people doing antisocial stuff in the city centre and in other town centres who are intimidating people on the street, who are defecating or urinating in public, those kinds of things. And we know we have homelessness happening in our town centres. Actually, a lot of our homelessness is hidden, but that's the visible manifestation of it, right? And from my point of view, we should be ashamed that we have people who have to live in that way. I don't walk past people who are begging or who are homeless and think, oh, I wish I couldn't see them because they're doing something wrong. I wish I couldn't see them because they didn't need to be there. And there's been this really unhelpful conflation of what's happening here when actually we know that the people who are rough sleeping are actually at risk of that antisocial behaviour, at risk of violence from a different group of people. That's been discussed repeatedly, including in those meetings with cabinet ministers, and I'm really angry that they have chosen to include rough sleeping and all forms of begging in the move-on orders, which are dubious anyway, because police actually already have the powers to do a lot of the things that government claim move-on orders are necessary to do. I have friends who were arrested at uni for public urination on pub crawls. That was, 30 years ago. So they've included breach of the peace, which breach of the peace is the original, the OG move-on order, right? It's existed for, probably centuries in British common law. And yet they're saying that they need to target the most vulnerable people, make them pay a $2,000 fine, which of course they can't pay, or they'll go to prison for 3 months. It's cruel.
That was Auckland Councillor Julie Ferry speaking to News Director Castor about the Council's annual plan and move-on orders for rough sleepers.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B. Text in your thoughts 5395.
Get out your speediest eyewear. The B-Rave is back and faster than ever before. B-Rave. Friday, March 6th at the Mothership.
Stepping up to the booth for your entertainment is a host of iconic 95 BFM DJs, including Co-Governance,
Rosetta from Breakfast, Nicholas from Drive,
Stinky Jim, Naru, back-to-back babyface killer, Porcelain, back-to-back pros.
Race you there. 95 BFM, Spades, Kira Huketsu and Under the Radar present B-Rave at the Mothership. Friday, March 6th. Tickets available now at Under the Radar.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Sheba.
What if you call it?
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Ah, guys, he finally asked me out. He says he knows a spot.
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God! It's a beer spot. I can try the new local brews.
The 95BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday only on 95BFM.
Thanks to the beer spot, your tappy place. It doesn't matter what season we're in, every Saturday morning on 95BFM, you'll hear the fresh sounds of spring. So close your eyes, tune into the blooming flowers, listen to that brook babble, and hear that lamb into the world.
The Saturday Spring with Karen Hay. Chats, tunes, and everything you need to start your weekend. Saturday mornings, 9 to 11, only on 95BFM.
I'm not sure of our position on that particular bill, so I can't comment on that right now.
It's a kind of bird. This is the bird they're endorsing for Bird of the Year.
The Wire.
The New Zealand government is currently in talks with officials from the United States about a new border security agreement that would allow New Zealanders' biometric information to be handed over to the US government. The US is currently adjusting the requirements of its enhanced border security partnership that applies to the 42 countries in its visa waiver program, including New Zealand. The new agreement could give the United States full, automated access to other countries' national databases. This is compared to current agreements, where biometric checks only provide minimal information, with further information only considered on a case-by-case basis. I spoke to the chair of the New Zealand Council for Civil Liberties, Thomas Beagle, about this issue. I started by asking if he could explain the recent negotiations and how they differ from the existing situation.
Sure. It's about the US visa waiver scheme, which is a scheme which allows people travelling from New Zealand to the US to basically, rather than having to go to the embassy and apply for a visa or some process of that sort, they can just apply on the way for a visa waiver. And that will then let them into the States. Now, in the past, there has been some, we understand there has been some communication between the US government and the NZ government, which was used to validate some of that information. And my understanding is that information is of the level of sort of, you know, does this person have a criminal record? And they will get a yes, no answer back. The new scheme is much more invasive. Rather than just sort of the sort of carefully gated information going back and forth, the US government is actually looking for extensive information about people travelling to their country. They are looking both from our government in terms of access to biometric data and to full records about the person travelling and to about the people they're travelling with or the people that they might know. And at the same time, they're also looking at asking travellers for a lot more information directly. For example, we've seen the mention of 5 years of social media history and social media accounts, so they can go and examine those as well.
How concerned are you about this new scheme, and why are you concerned?
Oh, well, we're very concerned about it because it's a gross invasion of New Zealanders' privacy, and it's also giving up data sovereignty over our own data. I mean, we understand that the New Zealand government needs to collect information about people here in order to do normal government functions, you know, police and health and everything else. And the thought of giving carte blanche access to that to a foreign country seems very, very, very worrying to me. And it's particularly worrying when we consider that the US is actually possibly not in a good state at the moment. It's steadily heading to a more authoritarian and form of rule, and this information is going to be collected, it's going to be stored, and it's going to be used against people from New Zealand. So I think it's a really big concern for us.
Have the recent events with the United States entering a war with Iran impacted your level of concern at all?
Well, absolutely, of course. I mean, the whole point is that they're trying to capture as much information as they can and then add it to a large databases. That's kind of how the surveillance state works. Now, you may think, oh, what's the problem for me? Well, okay, say you've made some comments critical of this American attack on Iran. That may be online. That may be used against you if you apply for a visa. We've already seen journalists and other people who have made statements critical of Donald Trump who have been then turned back at the US border. But that's only you, right? There's also the problem that, say, you're friends with some people who immigrated from Iran a few years ago, okay? And you've made some statements anti the strikes and so on, and that information can be used to link you to those Iranian people. And of course, we know that the Americans are currently keenly looking for targets to strike. So that information which you're giving and the links you've made to people you know may be used to actually target attacks in Iran. I mean, it's the US government as a whole and everything they do. And that's actually the threat partly.
Auckland University law professor Jihan Gunasekera stated that New Zealand is not in a strong position to negotiate on this compared to the European Union, for example. Is this also your assessment?
Well, we are obviously limited in our power and so on. There's been a lot of arguments saying we should be cozying up to the Europeans on a number of fronts around privacy and access to data on the grounds that if we can, you know, ride their coattails on that, that will be helpful. And it's part of, but it's also a choice we can make. I mean, the price of this, the price of actually maintaining independence and protecting people in New Zealand might be the cost, might be actually dropping out of that visa waiver scheme and making it harder to travel to the US. I mean, that's going to have to be a decision that the government's going to have to make, and I think people might want to weigh in on that. I mean, I'm starting to suspect that the price is actually too high, and we may have to drop out of that, and it's going to be a pain, but that's just how it is.
And what has been the public response to this so far? Is there any appetite to, as you say, make it harder to go to the US if it means protecting our data?
I don't know the outcome. I know that a lot of people reacted pretty strongly to the idea of giving the American government access into New Zealand government databases, and they seem to be very strongly against it, and a lot of the people I've seen. I think everyone's aware of what's happening in the US. But even then, I mean, you think about it as in terms of the US, and also think about what other countries will we give this access to. And the answer is we shouldn't be giving this access to anyone. And I think people want to maintain that data, that sovereignty over their own data.
That was Thomas Beagle from the New Zealand Council for Civil Liberties on the United States government getting automated access to New Zealanders' biometric data.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire. The Wire.
This weekend, we'll see the West Papua Solidarity Forum hosted at the University of Auckland's Old Coral Hall. The forum looks into the struggles faced by the people of West Papua against ongoing colonialism and repression by the Indonesian government. As part of the forum, Academy Cinema will be hosting a West Papuan film night this Saturday, highlighting the struggles faced by locals. To discuss the context behind the struggles in West Papua and the event this weekend, News Director Castor spoke to activist and former Green Party MP Catherine Delahunty.
What is the historical context, particularly around the colonial heritage of West Papua?
Yes, so the West Papua was part of the Dutch colonies and was, after World War II, the southern part of the island Papua New Guinea, which is much better known, was handed over to the Australians and eventually obtained independence. The northern part of West Papua, the area known as West Papua, was being prepared by the Dutch for its own independence in the 1960s after the war. And basically, John F. Kennedy and the Indonesians said, no, we want it, because they wanted a buffer against communism, so they wanted to hand it to Indonesia. And they also had like massive, one of the biggest gold mines in the world opening up there, and they wanted to control the resources. So since the 1960s, it's been occupied by Indonesia with every other Western country's collusion. And it's been a violent occupation and an environmental ecocide process to strip resources and control the people. So it's a very secret story because there's basically a media ban, and most people, even though we're only their neighbours, they're only an hour from Darwin, most people in this country do not really know anything about West Papua. And I have to say that very few media outlets, apart from honourable mentions like yourselves and Radio New Zealand and Māori media, take any interest in this whatsoever.
And so then if we're thinking about increasing awareness, what's this event going on and what's the focus?
Yeah, so the West Papua Solidarity Forum is happening this weekend. We're actually at Auckland Uni and we're also out in South Auckland. We're having two different days. One is a whole series of panels and speakers at Auckland Uni at the law school there,
at the Coral, Old Coral Hall. And the second day is basically at this lovely venue called the Taro Patch. And the purpose of these of the day is to educate and raise awareness. We have five guests from West Papua. So they're coming to speak on different topics. They are arriving in the next 24 hours. So that's pretty exciting. And we really are trying to educate people. But even more exciting is that on the forum on the first day is fully booked. We can't register any more people, which is great. Shows how much interest there is. But there is a wonderful film which is tells the whole story in a very powerful way, which is on at the Academy Cinema just downtown there on Saturday at 6 p.m. which there are plenty of tickets, and everyone is welcome to come and watch this film, which is it's really a powerful explanation of just why West Papua was occupied, who was doing it, who is silent, and who is paying the price. And it's really important in these times of climate chaos as well, because they're destroying, well, it's one of the greatest rainforest destructions on the planet right now is what's happening to the people and the land of West Papua.
And so if we're thinking of raising awareness and providing support from down here in Aotearoa, what can we do and what more could our government do to provide support?
Yes, this is one of the reasons we're holding the forum, is we're trying to gather up more people, especially younger people who might like to be part of the solidarity movement. We actually have little groups of people all across the country, but they need to be big groups because we need to put a lot more pressure on our government. So the two things we want people to do is to tell people about this issue, to get them to look at it. There's plenty of information online about West Papua, but there's very little, people have very little interest or focus. We all know about Palestine, and it's an absolute genocide. This is a different form of genocide, but it's in our neighbourhood, and it's more of a structural genocide. And you know, we've got 160,000 displaced people over there right now, and we really need New Zealanders, people of Aotearoa, to wake up to this issue and to put pressure on the government. Because as you ask, what can the government do? The government could stand up to Indonesia while maintaining a positive relationship. You can, in diplomatic terms, it is more than possible to draw important lines, and important lines must be drawn with Indonesia over their violence and their occupation, their reign of terror, and their militarization of West Papua. We're having a political panel at the forum on Saturday. Interestingly, only one party has actually agreed to send someone along, and that was the Greens, with Te Anau Tui Ono, who has been a strong champion for West Papua and his time in Parliament, as I was when I was a Green MP.
You also mentioned earlier some colonial ties as well. I've seen some stuff in some of the press releases that have been put out and some of the coverage of this issue, that there's still links that this occupation has to colonising forces, including the United Kingdom and including the Netherlands. Could you go a bit into that?
Sure. The colonial history is not the past. This is neo-colonialism. I mean, the film that we're showing on Saturday is called Pester Barbie, The Pig Feast, a neo-colonial story. So it is a neo-colonial story because the colonists, the great colonising empires from the Dutch East Indies and the Netherlands and the British Empire, not to mention the Americans as modern colonists, they take no responsibility for what's happened in Papua, even though they were all actively involved. And, for example, there was a vote at the UN decided to have a referendum in West Papua, which was a complete phony referendum held at gunpoint in the 1960s, which is how they justify the occupation. But I think there's a huge racist colonial element to this story. So very, very clearly, the Indonesians use racism and attack the culture of West Papuans and diminish them in a way that all colonial racist occupations do. And so if you want to sort of think of an example, you think about Aotearoa in 1863, where there was war, there was land grab, there was absolute racism and throughout the power structures that we're taking over. That's exactly what we're seeing in West Papua in 2026.
And who are the kind of speakers that people could be running into at this event this weekend?
Key speakers is Dortea Wabisa. She's only 27. She works for an organisation called Pusaka, which is based in Jakarta, but she's Papuan and she spends most of her time in West Papua and telling the world about the issues. And she's an environmental champion. And so she's been witnessing the destruction that's taking place, which we show in the movie, and the place in West Papua called Maroki, which is like massive forest destruction and communities being driven out of their homes and alienated. And so, you know, she's Dortea is an inspiring young woman. We have Victor Mumble, who's the producer. He's a journalist who's won numerous awards from international journalism for his courage and clarity. And he's speaking about the films that he has been part of through his group, the Jubi Media Network. We have an Indonesian, so he's West Papua, but he works closely with an Indonesian, a very brave Indonesian filmmaker called Dandi Dwi Laksono, who has stood up to the regime in Indonesia over the issues of corruption and violence and is the director of the film that we're showing. Ronnie Carini, who is a young man from West Papua who was born in the refugee camp, he's coming from Australia where he's based, where he works with the universities and communities, and he also works closely with young people right across West Papua, supporting youth to use culture, music, art, as well as political diplomacy to advance the cause. And then we've got some people from other Pacific nations speaking. Dr. Emelani Casey is a Hawaiian academic from Auckland University. Dr. Nathan Rue, who is Papua New Guinean, who did an amazing PhD on the Pacific as an empty ocean in the minds of colonists, whereas in fact it's a deeply loved and connected series of relationships, including with Papuan people. So we've got lots of really cool speakers, and we are really looking forward to hearing from them. And then on the second day, we're doing a whole lot of workshopping out at Papa Puatoi to build our movement and support this really important kaupapa.
That was activist and former Green MP Catherine Della Hunte speaking to News Director Kester about the continued colonisation and oppression in West Papua and the West Papua Solidarity Forum this weekend. You can find more details in this interview's BCast on our website later today.
Doesn't give my opponents much time to run up to an election, does it?
The Wire.
We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B. This is Trouble by Voom.
Yeah. It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Late last year, the High Court ruled against the Ministry of Social Development on one of their practices in recovering welfare payments. MSD had, for the last 20 years, required that successful ACC claimants pay back any supplementary assistance they had received while waiting for their claim to be resolved, such as through the accommodation supplement. This approach would often mean claimants would be left with a significantly reduced payout and even debt. Last month, the government began passing legislation that would retroactively make these practices legal, slashing any hopes of forgiving the outstanding debts that were, until recently, unlawful. The Social Security Accident Compensation and Calculation of Weekly Income Amendment Bill has been pushed through Parliament under urgency, limiting scrutiny. However, despite a narrow timeframe to submit on the Select Committee, over 800 responses were received. Producer Theo spoke to Dr. Susan St. John, Honorary Associate Professor at the University of Auckland and one of the submitters to the Bill Select Committee, about the consequences this legislation will have.
Kia ora. So first of all, it's a little bit hard to wrap your head around what this legislation actually is. So can you briefly tell us what's going on with this bill that the government's trying to push through Parliament?
Well, I do sympathise with what you've said there. It is extremely difficult to get your head around exactly what's involved here. In essence, and just over simple, really, what was happening was that when a claimant had ACC back pay, reflecting the fact that they'd had to wait for some time before ACC approved their claim, that back pay essentially cancels out whatever benefits had been paid in the interim. And maybe that's fair enough for a core benefit, but the argument is about the supplementary benefits that somebody on a benefit may access simply because they need extra assistance for accommodation, food, for special disability support, that kind of thing, which the ministry had been treating rather inconsistently, and there was a dispute over the MSD creating debts for a claimant where there wasn't enough back pay to cover this. And so that was taken to court, and the High Court decision was that what the MSD had been doing by deducting these supplementary payments was illegal. Instead of appealing that decision, which one might have thought would have been logical, the government chose to change the law and to change it retrospectively and thought that they would be able to push it through extremely quickly.
So the government was found to be doing something unlawful and is now retrospectively pushing through legislation to make what they did legal?
Yes, and I think they really underestimated how much outrage there would be. I couldn't understand at the first reading why Labor voted for it, but that was to ensure that it had a select committee process. So the government had assumed that it could push it through under urgency without the usual scrutiny for this kind of thing. And Labor managed to get the agreement that it would go to a select committee. Now, unfortunately, the time between the bill being released and the final close-off time for submissions was 2.5 days. And most of us have other jobs, but astonishingly, there was 850 submissions. Now, it took me 12 hours to do my submission. You can imagine 850, the effort that went into that. So that was to be in last Friday at midnight, and then the select committee met on Monday of this week and heard 8 of those submissions. Then it went away and wrote its report, put the report out, and we had the second reading yesterday. And the second reading was voted to go to committee stage with an amendment that National had suggested, which had has minimal impact as far as I can see. But with the committee stage, there is the possibility of negotiating other kinds of amendments with the other parties. I don't know what's been going on in Parliament today or when it comes back into the House for its final reading, but you can see what a pressured system it is.
Yeah, and just touching on that, I mean, the government's pushed this through quite quickly, so it must be a fairly unpopular kind of policy with at least some stakeholders. Who are the people who are going to be most affected or, in fact, harmed by this legislation going through?
Yes, well, the 850 shows you that a lot of people are affected. And, of course, some of those submissions are from people who advocate and the legal firms who help ACC claimants with their reviews. But when we think about the people that are actually affected, many of those have made submissions as well. And they tend to be amongst the worst off, the people that have had to go on benefits, they had no other means of support. It reflects long-term claim issues that have been delayed or been prolonged in some way by ACC before decision. This could be sensitive claims. It could be people who have argued for a loss of potential earnings compensation because of injuries they sustained before they were earning, or they were on a student allowance or something like that. So those people are the ones whose submissions should have been given a great deal of attention. And I can't see how the Select Committee had time to read those 850 submissions.
No, and just to be clear, if someone is receiving a main benefit while they're awaiting for an ACC claim to be resolved and they're accessing these supplementary forms of income, if they're accessing those supplementary forms of income and then they eventually get that claim and it is less than the supplements that they were receiving overall, does that mean that they would be placed into debt to repay those supplements?
Yes, it's quite astonishing. And I must say, it's taken me a little bit of time just to think that one through, because here you have people who thought by entering into this process with their ACC claim that they would be advantaged in the long run, and some of them clearly are not.
I mean, that's astounding, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, what's the point of pursuing an ACC claim if in the end the money is just going to be shuffled to a different area of government and leave them saddled with debt? I mean, a abuse and care survivor who had gone through this process in good faith, after being urged to lodge an ACC claim, they could potentially be left with more debt after this process.
Yeah, and wondering why on earth they put themselves through all that trauma of trying to get the ACC claim established, you know, using advocacy, all the sorts of processes they have to go through. Why did they bother if that was going to be the outcome? Of course, you know, they would be on the ACC weekly compensation payment from in the future, once it was established. So they would gain in the future, possibly, from being there, but with a debt. And that debt might be repaid slowly or not, who knows. Something would be hanging over their heads, and it's just quite astonishing that that could have been the case.
Yeah, and you've mentioned Labor's earlier support for this legislation. Now, since then, they've announced that they would be looking for giving the Ministry of Social Development discretionary powers in whether to pursue clawbacks that would cause future hardship and inequity, to not claw back disability and rehab allowances, and to exempt victims of abuse in state care. But is that enough in your view?
In my view, the whole bill should have been thrown out, and we should have been asking the question, how exactly are we operating this system? What is wrong with it? What are all the unintended consequences happening already? And why do we want to solidify that into a law which doesn't give discretion to the Ministry of Social Development? So it would, to me, be appropriate to have the bill thrown out.
Yeah, and one of the unintended consequences that you've highlighted in your recent Substack article was that of how this policy change also has implications for those claimants who have partners.
Yes, I'm still finding this unbelievable. But because the benefit system is based on the notion of a married couple as the unit, so where there's a partnership, this might be a benefit for both of them at the couple rate. Apparently, that is all clawed back as well from the one partner who's making the claim because they're injured. I find that unbelievable, and it's part of a wider problem within the welfare system of not treating people as individuals, as they are in ACC, and with these kind of arrangements, trying to marry two different types of system together. And of course that generates all these different forms of inequity.
So it's effectively penalising claimants who have a partner.
One would perceive that, yes, unbelievably. I mean, that's actually not the only thing that should have been looked at. We should have also been looking at how the system impacts on reclaiming things like working for families, or how working for families actually work. And I've just been toying with this thought that if somebody is losing all their benefit for the periods of back pay, and so they are deemed to be on ACC alone in that period, they could be eligible for the in-work tax credit. I mean, who's talking about these sorts of things?
And the Minister for Social Development, Louise Upston, has said that overall these changes bring practices into alignment with long-standing policy. I mean, does this align with the mission or spirit of the Ministry of Social Development or ACC in New Zealand and our wider social security system?
No, not with ACC. I think with the benefits system, the idea that you have a highly targeted system and you mustn't give more than a dollar than is actually earned or deserved within that system is very harsh. And the harshness of it is reflected in this bill and the consequences of that.
That was Honorary Associate Professor Susan St. John on the inequitable impact of the Social Security Amendment Bill currently being rushed through Parliament.
That was The Wire.
Ko era te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kororo mai ki māua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on The Wire for Rā Pārī Thursday. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, Labour's Shannon Halbert, Auckland Council's Julie Ferry, the New Zealand Council for Civil Liberties' Thomas Beagle, former Green MP Catherine Delahunty, and the University of Auckland's Susan St. John. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1 to 4 with Sophia.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.